Dr. Google can't fix your knee. The Joint Relief Institute can. Fast joint pain relief, covered by Medicare. Call 708-888-0000, as in zero pain.
Hello, and thanks so much for staying with us. Welcome to the Wintrust Business Lunch. Hope your Monday is off to a great start. Despite it being a gloomy Monday, my name is Jisoo Ki, and today marks my first day as host at this hour. I was on vacation last week, so a few thank yous to the folks who filled in for me. John Hansen, Elise Glink, and Amy Guth, both of whom you'll hear later on in the second half hour of the show. And as always, to Steve Bertrand, news anchor extraordinaire, always holding down the fort. So let's go ahead and get started. In studio with us today, we have Catherine Davis. She is the associate editor at Chicago Inno. Hi, Catherine. So, Catherine, just remind us what Chicago Inno is and does.
And we got our start in 2014, and we cover the city's tech and startup scene. So everything from Groupon and Grubhub down to the small grassroots companies just getting off the ground.
And you started off today with some breaking news about a tech company.
Yeah. So Uptake, they're actually one of Chicago's fastest growing tech companies. What they do is predictive analytics. So basically a software that helps other companies keep track of when their machines are likely to break down. And the news on Friday actually was that they laid off 23 people. And this is kind of the latest round of layoffs for the company. Last year, they laid off about 200 people.
Ooh, that's a lot.
Yeah. So, you know, kind of some bad news for Uptake. They say that the main reason is because they've finished building their software and now they don't need as many people to maintain it, you know. But we'll kind of just see how they fare going forward.
Well, do you think there's going to be more layoffs in the future? It sounds like they did a big round before and now a smaller one.
You know, it's unclear. Not sure exactly where they're headed. They told me that they are going to, you know, start to see some more stability now that they're kind of streamlining their operations more and getting accustomed to working, you know, just on expanding the software rather than kind of building it from the ground up. So.
Is this something specific just to Uptake, or do you think this has to do with their line of business, which is predictive analytics? Is it a crowded market?
So I don't think so. The thing about Uptake is that they are doing something pretty novel and unique. I think, you know, the founder was saying in a blog post that he just kind of overestimated how many people it takes to build. You know, they told me they were scaling too quickly, which is often a problem we see with startups is that, you know, to get market mm-hmm. share, they're like, let's just grow as quickly as possible and figure out the rest later. So that's kind of, you know, the downside of building a startup is that founders often get caught up in that. But as far as what Uptake's product is, it is pretty unique in its industry.
That's awesome. But we're definitely thinking about all the folks that were laid off, and hopefully they'll be able to find new jobs.
Absolutely.
Out in the market. Let's talk about something really exciting. Happy news. You guys just did a roundup of notable Chicago startups that were acquired in 2019. So we're at the end of 2019. So a lot of businesses. I'm assuming this is a dream come true when you have a business that you've started and somebody comes along and buys it for a lot of money.
Absolutely. I mean, that's kind of like the startup, you know, dream story, right? Is that either your company is acquired or ends up going public. In Chicago, we actually see more tech companies getting acquired than going public. You know, we just had the WeWork saga. So you kind of see that sometimes the public market isn't quite as friendly to tech companies as they thought it was going to be.
And that's another company that grew too fast.
Exactly. Yeah.
Very similar to Uptake.
Right. And so, you know, coming up on the end of the year in Chicago, and we like to take a look back, do some end of year content. And one of the notable companies that was acquired this year was Reverb. They were acquired by Etsy for $275 million.
Well, tell us what Reverb does.
So they have built an online marketplace where shoppers can buy and sell new, used, and vintage music gear. They have an office, I think, up in Lincoln Park. They've grown to, you know, I think 80, 100 employees. And it sounds like the founders and investors had a big payday with that acquisition.
That sounds amazing. And they were purchased by Etsy.
Right.
Which is a company that everyone is very familiar with.
Right. Kind of that online marketplace to find, like, you know, custom made jewelry and crafts and things of that sort.
Well, I think we have time for one more we can mention. Amazon bought a health navigator. What's that?
Yeah, so Health Navigator, Chicago digital health startup, and they provided telehealth tools, so like digital tools, like online symptom checkers, health bots, and other telehealth applications to, you know, allow people to get healthcare anywhere they are.
Well, we're going to talk about a lot more of notable Chicago startups that were just acquired in 2019. We are back here on the Wintrust Business Lunch, and we are talking with Catherine Davis, Associate Editor at Chicago Inno. And we were just talking about a roundup of the notable Chicago startups that were acquired in 2019. So we went over two. We went over Health Navigator and then also Reverb, which was purchased by Etsy. What other ones do you want to go over?
Yeah, so Orison Alps, they were a Chicago startup just launched in 2016. And they made like organic skincare products for men. The two founders, they're two women, and they came up with the idea because they were kind of, disappointed with the resources for men when it came to skincare, right? They didn't have many options. It wasn't as specialized as it is for us women, you know? And so they're like, let's build a line like this. And they were acquired this year by SC Johnson for about $20
million. $20
million? Yeah. And I think that the startup only employed like less than 10 people. So that's, you know, pretty significant to grow a company like that, to be acquired by such a big like conglomerate and kind of have a cash out in that way.
So, Catherine, to me, this is the American dream because
right.
It doesn't require coding skills. You don't have to understand the stock market. You just had to create a product with 9 other people in your home. And then eventually the product is so good that a huge company comes along and buys it.
Yeah. I mean, Orison Alps is sold in major retailers like Target. And, you know, people know this brand.
So there's hope for me yet. I just have to think of a product.
For
and
sure.
It can be as simple as soap for men. And goodness knows, men need soap. Just kidding. Another startup you want to mention?
Yeah. So another one is StratX. They were a Chicago-based HR and payroll software company, and they were acquired by a Boston tech company called Toast. And basically, you know, StratX's software allows restaurants to automate scheduling, applicant tracking, payroll benefits, kind of just streamlining the restaurant industry and how they manage their staff.
Well, when you think about restaurant industry and restaurants and how many employees they have, front of house, back of house, the managers, it's just a huge undertaking.
Lot.
So if there is software that can make that easier, I imagine you can really own the market if you have something that's superior.
Yeah, I mean, their clients included like Dunkin' Donuts, Jimmy John's, Girl and the Goat. So, you know, people right here in Chicago.
Oh, nice. Oh, another one you got?
So one other is they are called teeoff.com. And they were acquired by NBC Sports. Terms of the deal weren't disclosed for that one, so we don't really know how big the deal was, you know.
Does that generally mean it was a ton of money?
Well, that's the thing. It kind of goes either way, right? It could be a ton, but it could also be kind of very low, and the founders don't want to kind of expose maybe not the greatest deal. So, you know, because we've covered acquisitions up to $1 billion, and then we've covered small as 20 million. So it kind of just varies.
So as regular folks, we hear about acquisitions, but not all acquisitions are made alike. It doesn't necessarily mean that you're giving up control or complete ownership of your company, right?
Right. I mean, like in Reverb's case, they are still considered a standalone business. So I'm sure like the original founders, CEO, are still there running things on the day-to-day basis. They just now have a parent company. But other times you do see the company that was acquired get folded into the larger brand. So, you know, that company may not be known as that anymore. They change their name, et cetera. So it just kind of varies depending on the company.
Okay, so let's change gears a little bit. That was some really good news. It means that some people really got some good paydays here in Chicago. What else is going on that you think we should know about?
Yeah, so Julia Canoes, she is the CEO of the Illinois Technology Association. She's been at that role for the last 5 years, and she's been really integral in elevating women in tech. So since she's been there, the ITA has rolled out new accelerator programs. programs for women. It's focused more on them in their annual award ceremony. But Julia announced earlier this month that she is stepping down from that role. And she is going to ISACA, which is a Schomburg-based global IT association. So kind of in the similar neck of the woods, still working in tech and elevating Chicago's reputation as a tech hub in general. But now the ITA is looking for someone to replace her.
And the program that she started was called Women Influence Chicago Initiative. And that was the accelerator that you were speaking of.
Yeah.
And how did it help businesses accelerate?
Yeah. So, you know, it was different from some other accelerators around town that focus on women founders. The ITA accelerator actually was for women working at tech companies. So not necessarily the ones that founded them, but just, you know, were working as software developers or in other roles and helping them to climb the corporate ladder. So, you know, Julia was telling me that in the accelerator, they've helped women negotiate for higher salaries and to advocate for themselves for rate or for promotions and just, you know, moving forward in tech in general, because oftentimes you see women kind of at those mid-level roles in the tech industry kind of plateau out. And the higher C-suite or executive level roles are going to men more often.
And those challenges for women still exist and the gap is still great, right?
Absolutely. I mean, I think earlier this year, the ITA came out with some data that said just 6% of tech CEOs in Chicago are women. You know, that's really small. Like, we got to do something about that. And the ITA is working, too. So
she is going to be definitely very missed at the company. But it sounds like Julia is still going to be involved, though.
Exactly. She's going to serve on the board of directors. And she's hoping that, you know, in her new role at ISACA, she's going to learn things that she can bring back to the ITA and kind of get them to be a bigger, more robust organization as a result.
Love it. More women power. absolutely.
Girl power.
Yes, indeed. What else is going on?
Yeah. So on the funding side, Leaf Trade, they are a marijuana tech company, which is super hot right now because, recreational legalization.
Absolutely. Everybody is talking about it.
Exactly. And so, you know, as part of legalization, there's a new opportunity now for tech enabled companies operating the marijuana industry to really grow. And, you know, especially in Illinois. And that's what Leaf Trade does. They've built an enterprise software for cannabis dispensaries and growers. So ideally, they're connecting dispensaries with cultivators so that they can buy cannabis products in bulk and then sell it in their retail locations.
So what are some of the pros and cons that you see in this system?
Well, you know, the thing about operating in the marijuana tech industry is that there's still a lot of regulation around it. It is hard to operate, even though marijuana will be legal here in Illinois. Federally, it's still illegal. So when it comes to banking and advertising, these kinds of companies run into a lot of issues because they still have to comply with, you know, FTC regulations and SEC regulations. So.
But I think this is a very unique way of finding your niche in this new market that's burgeoning, because they're going to be helping create a platform where vendors can really, they're going to make it so simple for them to place orders and manage order fulfillment and see all the analytics.
Exactly. Like, you think of these big dispensaries like Verano Holdings or Green Thumb Industries. Those two are actually clients of Leaf Trade. You know, like, they use that to sell and make their marijuana products because they have to get the, you know, actual plant from someone. But, you know, we were talking about Leaf Trade last week because they raised $4.5 million in funding to expand this. I think they're in about 12 states now and they want to get to 20 by the end of the year. So they only got 2 or 3 weeks, but they're on a mission.
So is this a company that is going to see a lot of growth in terms of new hires, you think?
So that's what they say. I think now they employ about 20 people and they plan to add about 15 in 2020. So almost doubling the staff. You know, funding is usually used to, like we were talking about earlier, kind of get that market acquisition. So that needs a lot of people to help, right? So it'll be interesting to see how they grow next year.
Yeah, definitely. I think we have time for you to enlighten us on one more happening locally.
Yeah. So Review Trackers, they're a tech company that listeners may be familiar with. They've been around since 2012, but they raised $10 million over the summer. And that money, a lot of that money has been used to open a new headquarters for them in the Loop. And so Chicago, I know we do office envies where it's basically a slideshow of like, hey, look at this awesome tech office. and, you know, how well it's designed, not just your boring, like, plain white walls. But Review Tracker's moved into this new office, and it can accommodate up to 140 people. They grew from 50 to 90 just since June. So, I mean, they are on, like, laser-focused growth, and, you know, really excited about this new office.
And does this look like it's going to be sustained growth?
I think so, yeah. So basically what they do is they operate a software platform that helps companies, so think like restaurants, hospitals, mm-hmm. really any kind of company with several locations, to track and manage customer feedback. So, you know, this comes really in handy for a restaurant, right? If you have people complaining on Google versus Yelp versus, you know, other online review platforms, Review Trackers gives it all to you in one place.
Oh, Yelp, the people complaining on Yelp. That's always such a thing. Catherine Davis, Associate Editor at Chicago Inno. Thank you so much for being with us. Where can we read more?
Yeah, you can find out more at chicagoinno.com, and there you can sign up for The Beat, our daily email newsletter.
This is 720 WGN, and we're going to be coming up with a lot more. This is the Wintrust Business Lunch with G2P, and we are joined now by the great Elise Glink. How are you, Elise?
Hi, G. I'm doing great. Thank you. How are you?
Fantastic. I have to tell you, last week, you did such a great job. I listened to your podcast twice.
Well, thank you. It's very nice of you to say. It's always fun to sit in and talk to people about money, right?
Yeah, you're a wealth of information, truly. So what's going on today? You've got some information about the Gen Zs and the millennials.
So, you know, let's think about real estate for a moment. And the next generation that's going to be home buyers are Gen Z. And the reason I say that is the millennials are so far still falling flat as far as real estate agents and brokers around the country are concerned. They do make up more than half of the home buyers now, but it's really just millennials own about a third fewer homes that Gen X or baby boomers did at the exact same age. So the push is slow.
I hate to interrupt, but just really quickly, can we describe what the difference between a millennial and a Gen Z is?
Absolutely. So millennials are aged about 24 to about 38, 39, and the Gen Zs are the ones that come after them. So the I think millennials, it's typically described as like 1982 to 1995 mm-hmm. when they were born, and Gen Zs are after that.
Got it. Wow. Okay. And continue. So we're talking about the home buying preferences.
Yeah, Gen Zs are a very different generation, and I find it endlessly fascinating to think about how it is that these generations get formed and how really smart generational experts know what they're going to be like before they actually come of age. And with Gen Z, one of the things that they said is that this is a much more savvy generation financially, much more so than millennials who have a lot of debt, both student loan debt and credit card debt, and now they're taking on auto loans. But Gen Zs are a little bit smarter, and so the real estate industry is really hoping that they're going to be much more focused on buying a home and all of the wonderful financial benefits that flow after that. And it looks like their desires for homeownership are much stronger than the millennial generation.
So how did that happen? Why is that different? Why are the Gen Zs more money savvy?
Well, it's interesting. According to generational experts, millennials kind of lived through the Great Recession and came out of it in 2010, 11, 12, getting their first jobs or second jobs and finding themselves really stymied. Gen Zs were watching their parents struggle through the Great Recession and watched them lose their homes and realize that they really better need to, you know, count all their pennies and not be such throwing money around. And so there's this idea around the recession really affecting different generations in different ways.
So there's a historical reference, but then also there's a cultural difference as well.
It is, and it's sort of interesting. One of the studies, we looked at studies by Bank of America and Merrill Lynch and also Freddie Mac, and more than half of prospective Gen Z home buyers, now remember, the oldest of Gen Z is only like 21, 22, 23, they've already started saving to buy a house.
Wow.
And they already understand that it's not just the down payment, but they also need money for all the expenses of owning and maintaining a property, which is really unusual.
Now, I certainly wish I was as Gen Z now, but do you think social media has anything to do with this at all?
Well, I think what social media does is it allows people to see how they think the other half lives, but they really don't. But there certainly are enough images online, whether it's Pinterest or Instagram, of beautiful homes that are enticing people, and real estate agents are out there pushing them as well. So I do think there's an awareness of it. But what Gen Z is really interesting about them is that they are the generational cohort most likely to have financial help when buying a home. So they already get that they don't have the money to do it, but they are getting help from their parents and grandparents' generation.
So you're saying that they're buying homes, or the goal is very ambitious, and it's they're buying homes 3 years younger than the current median home buying age. Is this something that you
want to?
Right. Would you advise this? Is this something that's wise to do?
So I say it in my book, 100 questions every first time home buyer should ask, and I say it in my columns and I say it online, the earlier you are when you buy a house, the wealthier you'll be later in life. Oh. And the reason I say that is because once you buy a house, all the other stuff you spend money on, there has to be a trade-off. You have a finite amount of income, and I get the whole part-time sidekick income thing, and that does help. But you have a finite amount of income, and buying a house is a legal obligation. And so people's sense of priorities just shift, and people start pouring money into their houses, and those are enforced savings accounts for them. And by the time you get to the end of the mortgage, your house is paid off, and you've got a big lump of equity. And for most Americans, the vast majority of their wealth is found in their homes that they own.
Now, Elise, is this the same type of advice you would give to, let's say, a Gen Z or even a millennial, whether they were thinking about purchasing a house within the city limits of Chicago versus maybe the suburbs?
I don't think it matters where you are when you buy. It's the magic of compounding, right?
Okay.
So every time you make a mortgage payment, a little bit goes for equity and a lot goes for interest. And over time, that ratio flips. So you're paying much more towards equity and very little towards interest. And that's really the magic of how all of this works on your behalf and makes your money work harder for you.
Got it. I was mostly asking because of property taxes and everything else that people complain about when they live in the city.
Well, but property taxes are high sort of everywhere. And I'd like to just say that I don't want to pay a dollar more than I have to. But when you travel around the country as much as I do and you start talking to people who are homeowners about local schools and police and fire and the other kinds of services that we depend on every single day to make a community run, you realize that while, yes, we have a pension issue, and I'm not negating that, we do invest a lot in this state in our teachers. And we have wonderful, wonderful teaching and wonderful schools in the city and in the metropolitan area in the state. And other states do not have that quality of public education. And so we're paying for it, maybe too much. Maybe the deals haven't always been the best ones to do for all the taxpayers. But when you compare what our students are getting to others, that's a big deal. And it's important for homeowners, because when you live in an area with good school districts, your home will appreciate faster and better over the long run than homes that are in not such good school districts.
Now, do you think also the difference between the Gen Zs and the millennials is perhaps less student loan debt? I know it's astronomical how much student loan debt we're in this country, and it seems a lot more people and families are taking a look at community colleges and state schools and maybe doing trade schools as well.
Well, I think they're very savvy that student loan debt is a killer, and it's a millstone around your neck financially, and it can stay there for up to 30 years if you end up refinancing those loans. So they're well aware of it. There's a lot of media. They do read about it online. They're a preferred choice of news. And they're trying to find out other ways around it, whether it's going through college in 3 years, asking for more help, going to still an excellent school that maybe one that's needing more enrollment, so they're more likely to give out financial aid. or whether it's, you know, starting at community colleges for 2 years and then transferring into a full university to get the actual degree, all of those are really helpful. And we see more and more people, especially in the technology industry, skipping college altogether and being self-taught in the world of coding, which is a high-paid job, and moving out into the world.
Well, we're talking about home buying preferences between Gen Z and millennials, but you also have another article on how do I get rid of my PMI on my mortgage. Can you go over that really quickly for us?
I'd be happy to. So private mortgage insurance is what you will be required to buy if you're putting down less than 20% on a home. So that's been the story for a long time. And there are something called a two-step mortgage where you get a first loan for 80% and a second loan for up to 20%. And then you don't need private mortgage insurance. So there are two different ways to go. But if you get private mortgage insurance, it's pretty darn expensive. And so the idea is to pay it off, pay down your house, pay up the equity so you get to that 20% level, or your home appreciates in value and then you can get refinanced and then be at that 80% level and then the private mortgage insurance goes away. But there are some very specific rules that every lender has if you're paying down your loan, and they may require you to keep private mortgage insurance for as long as 5 years before they allow you to get rid of it. And on thinklink.com, I have loads of articles about how to do this and how to approach your lender. If you call your mortgage servicer, they will send you the rules that your lender has for getting rid of private mortgage insurance.
Well, Elise, thank you so much. This is Elise Glink, founder and CEO of Best Money Moves. And the website where we can read more is?
thinklink.com.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Elise. We have the intelligent and lovely Amy Guth with us, the host of Crane's Daily Gist podcast. Hi, Amy. You have some breaking news happening right now, right? Oh, sorry. I got the wrong one. Sorry about that. Yes, I have it. I have you on. Yes, I do. I sure do. Let me turn you off and then back on. Are you on? I have the blue. The button is blue. For once, it is not a technical. Oh, okay. So it was partly technically.
It's all good.
Human error. I had your button on, but I didn't have you up.
It's the joy of live radio.
I know.
Anything can happen.
I almost made it, Amy.
It's all good.
I almost made it having hit all the buttons.
It's all good. Well,
forgive me, listeners.
There's a lot of buttons
in
front of you. There's a lot of buttons in front of you to get straight to the
show. All right. So you got some breaking news for us.
Yeah. So today on Crane's Daily Gist, we have the usual lineup of things, lots of news in the business sphere from our friends at Crane's, but also just a bit ago, we learned that, you know, we've been following this story about Outcome Health, which was the startup in Chicago. We've talked about it many times here on this station. And what they aimed to do was put advertising in doctor's office waiting rooms. We've seen those screens that kind of scroll through and talk about different drugs, things like that. Well, one of the executives, there have been many allegations and charges of fraud. And so one of the executives who was in charge of business development, Ashiq Desai, he has pleaded guilty to one count of wire fraud this morning in court. So he's not going to be sentenced until the other executives have had a trial. So kind of remains to be seen. But that, you know, it looks like that'll lessen his sentence to around 10 years, whereas otherwise he's looking at upwards of 30 years for some of these charges.
Well, I thought what was interesting is when you came in during the commercial break, you said this is a real heartbreaking story. So it sounded like something that people were really rooting for.
Well, you know, this particular company at one point was such a darling in the startup world here in Chicago. They raised a significant amount of money. The founders are all relatively young. You know, a lot of eyes were looking to them. A lot of people in the startup world just kind of were amazed at what they were doing, and they've really, you know, it's really taken a turn for the surprising. And you know, a lot of times in cases where startups fall apart, you don't necessarily see fraud charges coming from. You just see like, well, the startup fell apart. But this has really started to uncover and unravel this very intentional, you know, what looks like a very intentional scheme to defraud investors and clients. And so, you know, there's four people now that are facing some pretty serious charges. So there's about 26 total charges of fraud between the four of them.
Okay, Amy, we've got about a minute to cover a bunch of stories. First, the Boeing safety issue. This sounds scary.
Well, so Boeing has been embroiled in a scandal for a while with a 737 MAX jet, but now unrelated to that, there is a part that is on the wing. It's a wing slat issue, and Boeing has been fined by the FAA $3.9 million because they say, you know, the FAA is saying, you knew this part was defective. You and your suppliers did not do enough to stop this. So that's a thing. Boeing does have 30 days to appeal that. That's on the show today. But also, I talked with Crane's columnist Greg Hines about some passenger data at O'Hare that's suddenly very flat. And so that's raising questions around how are we going to pay for this very expensive proposal for improvements to O'Hare. We've all been in that situation where we land and then we're waiting a very long time for a gate. So, you know, we need those improvements to work around that. And yet, you know, if passenger data, if, you know, people are not coming through O'Hare, it's going to be hard to do that.
Well, people should listen later because you're going to have more about doctors moving to hospital employments and also new taxes for universities. Thank you so much, Amy Guth. But the news is next from the Northwestern Medicine Newsroom.